Today on Straight Talk Africa, a look at the Trump administration's U.S.-African policy. Is it a continuation of previous administration policies? Or as some have suggested, is it really a case of benign neglect? That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali.
And hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Esther Githui-Ewart, your social media reporter.
Today, it's a discussion and analysis on the U.S.-Africa policy of the Donald Trump administration.
And coming up later, our audience has weighed in on our topic through emails, Facebook and Twitter comments. We'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
Historically, new U.S. presidents focus on domestic concerns during their first year in office. America's 45th president, Donald Trump, appears to be no exception to that rule. But most people agree that his style of running the White House is unprecedented. My colleague, Paul Sisco, has more.
A new president often means a new direction for the country. Candidate Donald Trump campaigned on a promise to make America great again, a promise and hashtag that many voters responded to positively. President Trump, with a mostly supportive Republican Congress, has battled his way to what he says are positive moves on several domestic initiatives. Among them, trade reform and tax reform. He says his tax cuts benefit the middle class and businesses, large and small. The administration also had to respond to multiple disasters and tragedies, including a massive hurricane and its aftermath in Puerto Rico, floods in Houston, devastating wildfires in the American West, mass shootings in Las Vegas and Florida, and most recently, what appears to be a serial bomber in Texas. Top foreign policy concerns during President Trump's brief tenure in office have been the nuclear threat from North Korea, the continuing process to attain peace in the Middle East, Russia's meddling into the 2016 U.S. presidential election, and the subsequent Russia probe by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. President Trump has steadfastly denied that he has participated in or was aware of any collusion with the Russians. And the president has undergone some trials and tribulations maintaining his cabinet and top staff. The U.S.-African relationship has been on somewhat of a back burner, understandably. On his recent five-nation trip to Africa, outgoing Secretary of State Rex Tillerson reiterated America's commitment to Africa, its people, and its future.
We're very pleased to see that the African Union has named 2018 as the year for winning the fight against corruption. From high-level secret deals to petty bribes on the street, corruption really does steal the precious resources from job creators and entrepreneurs and others who would promote benefits to the greater society and to the citizens of those countries.
Louis Segisvery is a former counselor at the State Department.
Well, actually, I would say five pillars if we include humanitarian assistance. So if we include humanitarian assistance as the first pillar, the second pillar now has emerged to be security, counterterrorism, because that's become an increasing threat. Then, of course, is conflict resolution to reduce that level of conflict, which is so destructive to standard of living in Africa. And then there's economic development, which is very, very important. And then finally, good governance, building civic capacity. Those represent the five key pillars of our policy over the years.
Secretary Tillerson emphasized with his African hosts the need for continued cooperation, especially regarding security matters.
Good governance and transparency are essential to creating the conditions for economic growth and prosperity. And we look forward to continuing our joint efforts with the African Union to improve the business environment on the continent.
President Trump has repeatedly addressed foreign leaders, saying that making their nations great again is in America's interest and in the interests of people in Africa and around the world. Paul Sisco, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that interesting report. due to the ongoing snowstorm here in Washington, will be joined, or we are expected to be joined via telephone hookup by Ambassador Stephanie Sullivan, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. But our guest here in the VOA Washington studio is Malik Chaka, former director of the Millennium Challenge Corporation. He also served for several years as a staff member with the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Africa Subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives. I have to say, frankly, that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you once again on Straight Talk Africa, Malik Chaka.
It's both a pleasure and an honor to be here because we are speaking from Washington to Africa, and this is a program that is known around the entire continent.
You're most welcome, sir. Late, we'll get to interact with Ambassador Sullivan as soon as she is ready. Let me come to you immediately, Malik. You heard in the opening that, in fact, there was a question as to whether the Trump administration's foreign policy towards Africa is pretty much more of the same like previous administrations, or is it in fact a sort of benign neglect?
I think it's different because Mr. Trump, President Trump, is different. He's an unpresidential president. And if we look at the first year of his administration, Mr. Tillerson, the Secretary of State's trip to the Africa region was the first one by any high-ranking State Department official. Then this was followed by his demise shortly after he returned. So I think that folks on the continent are probably scratching their heads.
When you say that he is an unpresidential president, what exactly do you mean?
He's an unconventional fellow. Never been anybody, for example, who have made tweets such an important part of their means of communications. You could wake up one morning as a high-ranking official like Mr. Tillerson and find out that you don't have a job and hear it via tweet. I don't think that this would have happened at any other point in history. And people around the world are following what Mr. Trump says on Twitter, and in Africa, what they're following are things that go beyond African issues and African affairs.
Are there any indications that you could point to that suggest that he is indeed serious in terms of dealing with Africa, especially given that we've actually been, he's been in office for 1 year, and yet, we don't as yet have, for example, the man in charge or the woman in charge of U.S.-African policy. We're talking about the traditional U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs.
What I would say is that President Trump needs to be serious about Africa because U.S. national interests are intertwined with, tied up with Africa's interests. This is an administration, for example, that has placed a great deal of attention on counterterrorism. If we look at what's going on the continent today, this is inconceivable that the Trump administration could ignore what's going on the African continent. When you have ISIS and other organizations there, when you have al-Shabaab, when you have Boko Haram, et cetera, et cetera.
What about the previous administrations, which used to sometimes really focus on what they characterized as soft power?
Soft power is critically important. Good relationships with African countries and with the continent is very, very important. Mr. Tillerson leaving, for example, he had begun to establish relationships with some important African leaders. Now you have to start all over again, because on the continent, personal relations are in fact critically important. Mr. Tillerson would have been in a position to call Mr. Kenyatta, or to call Mr. Deby, or to call Mr. Buhari, and continue the conversation or ask for their support, because they had begun to develop a relationship. There needs to be continuity in these relationships between the U.S. government, African governments, and important continental organizations like the African Union.
Now, you talk about how Mr. Rex Tillerson, for example, would have been in a position to make a call to Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. I know this is a question probably that, in fact, should go to Ambassador Sullivan, but when you look at the events in Nairobi, the Kenyan capital, on March 9th, it was a Friday, you have this celebrated handshake between President Uhuru Kenyatta and I hear sometimes Raila Odinga, in fact, being referred to as His Excellency by Kenyan State House itself, Harambe House.
Yes.
Do you think that the Americans were behind that? Because let's face it, could it possibly have been a coincidence that the Secretary of State is about to land in Nairobi and we have that handshake?
I don't think that it was a coincidence. I would think that Ambassador Godec, a very able diplomat, has been involved. In Kenya, they were walking too close to the precipice. I thought back to 2007, 2008, when the situation had gotten entirely out of hand, and where the U.S. worked with Kenyan leaders to, in fact, put statesmanship and compromise at the center of developments. March 9th was a great day for Kenyans. It was a good day for Americans also, because Kenya is such a critically important country.
Very interesting. Now, I gather that we do have Ambassador Stephanie Sullivan online from Washington. She is, of course, the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Good afternoon, Ambassador Sullivan.
Hi, Shaka. How are you today?
I'm hugely terrific. I have to say, frankly, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Well, myself as well. I'm sorry I wasn't able to come in person due to all the snow, but I'm happy we were able to schedule this by phone.
Thank you so much. Let me give you the same question, really, that Malik Chaka just attempted to answer. You were in the delegation of Rex Tillerson, the former Secretary of State, correct?
He's the outgoing Secretary of State, yes.
The outgoing
and
Secretary.
I did participate in the trip.
You participated in the trip, and we're talking about this very important handshake in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, between Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga. Was the United States behind it?
Well, as I joined, I heard my colleague Malik's response. And what I would say is that I think the rapprochement between the two of them was a result of months of discussions behind the scenes that included our very capable Ambassador Bob Godec, as well as the other heads of mission who were coordinating very, very closely to help Kenya stay on the path moving forward. Nobody wanted to see a return to previous disruptions that had accompanied the electoral process. It was an electoral season full of twists and turns. But I think the essential thing is that it was a great day that demonstrated leadership on the part of both President Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga.
So what about, someone will ask you, what is the goal of that particular handshake? Are we looking again at some sort of government of national unity like happened back in 2008?
Not necessarily. I mean, my take on this is that it is an opportunity to be inclusive, bring all of the different aspects of Kenyan society together to map out an inclusive way forward. That doesn't necessarily mean a government of national unity per se, but the important thing is to have participation of the citizenry and inclusion, because I think that is how the country can move forward and maximize its potential.
I was reading a memo from State House Nairobi, specifically from Harambee House, and it repeatedly addressed Raila Odinga as His Excellency. What does that mean? Does it in fact mean that as we talk, Kenya probably has two presidents?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what document or transcript you were referring to.
It was a memo from State House Nairobi, specifically from Harambee House, the specific building where that handshake between President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga took place. That memo repeatedly addressed both as His Excellencies.
Look, I think that question is better directed to the Kenyans, but I think that is a term of respect and honorific. It doesn't, I don't read into that, you know, the two Mr. Presidents in any way.
I see. Now, Ambassador Sullivan, talk to us about the Trump administration's policy towards Africa, because there are a lot of critics and observers who actually say there is no such a thing as a Trump administration's U.S.-Africa policy in place as yet. Do you agree with them?
I don't agree, and I'm so glad that you asked this question and gave me the opportunity to address it. I think if you look at a number of very public engagements that we've had even before this trip with Secretary Tillerson, if you look at President Trump's meeting with 8 African heads of state at the UN General Assembly in September. If you look at the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, Tom Shannon's remarks at the U.S. Institute of Peace in September. If you look at Secretary Tillerson's and the State Department's hosting of the high-level dialogue with the African Union in November, followed by the ministerial with a good number, several dozen heads of foreign ministers, also in November, and then the secretary's speech right before getting on the plane on March 6th. He gave a speech at George Mason University. So let me summarize it and try to put to rest this idea that there is no Africa policy. There are really three main focuses, and that includes increased trade and development. It also includes regional security with a very strong emphasis on counterterrorism. And also it talks about governance and democracy. And I think what the administration would like people to know is that we feel there's a very strong interrelatedness and mutual reinforcement among these three areas, because if you have a community that doesn't have good economic opportunities, for example, or there's not good governance that provides services to the citizens, it can leave those communities vulnerable to extremist ideologies. And then it leads into having a security problem. So all of these things are related. And we were quite pleased to see that the African Union had selected this year as with a focus on the fight against corruption, which feeds into the governance piece. So if there's a nuance here, I think there's not a break with our previous focus that we've had a strong bipartisan approach towards Africa policy over multiple decades. But I think the nuance here is an emphasis more on the governance piece than maybe the vaguer emphasis on democracy, which in some cases had been misconstrued to mean, oh, let's just have an election and then we'll check that box. But that's not enough. You've really got to follow through and have the governance piece in place so that you help the communities thrive and inoculate them against some of these security threats.
How do you respond to some who say the perception seems to be that the policy, in their words, not mine, seems to be benign neglect?
If I were there with you, you would see me shaking my head. I think it's benign is too weak a word in the sense that we have a very strong passion for strengthening the partnerships between the United States and African countries. And it's certainly not neglect. I mean, we are working as busily as we ever have. I think that there may be people who are putting that storyline, that fake news out there to try to perhaps put us on the defensive. But there is a lot of activity, and we are committed to moving the relationships forward, both with individual countries and with the continent as a whole.
What about the reported budget cuts, for example? We're talking about 25 or 30% at the State Department. We're talking about 50% the last time I checked with regards to America's really most important, probably soft power to Africa. We're talking about YALI, or the Mandela Foundation Fellowship, rather.
Well, so we have a bit of a complicated budget process, and this is a good week to be talking about that because currently we are under a continuing resolution, which means we don't have a budget that the Congress has passed for 2018. So in our system, the executive branch proposes and the legislative branch disposes. That is, we don't have a budget until the Congress gives us a budget. So I think we have to wait until there is a budget to really know what the final numbers will be and what that will look like. But for planning purposes, in fact, we have looked at how to focus and concentrate our efforts and look at the areas that have had the most positive impact, where we're able to, you know, assess progress, and we want to continue in that vein. For example, there are several countries that are very close to reaching the end of epidemic for HIV/AIDS, and we're going to really focus on those countries, our PEPFAR assistance, to help them get over that hump. And then in future years, we can look at trying to bring the other countries along. So it's a different approach of kind of more of a focus and looking at results.
So,
but as I said, the budget numbers are not final yet. Once we get those numbers, we will most likely have to reassess and look at how we allocate the dollars that are provided for the soft power for Africa.
So if I heard you correctly, you mentioned PEPFAR. We're talking about the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. Do I understand then that PEPFAR is not going to be in no way affected at all?
That is not exactly what I said. There is going to be a continuity in terms of the provision of the antiretrovirals, but we're going to really try to focus the resources we have on the countries that are achieving or close to achieving the end of the epidemic. And so it's just a bit of a reallocation of those resources while we boost those countries over the epidemic threshold.
What about AGOA, the African the African Growth Opportunity Act?
Yes. So as you probably know, AGOA has been extended for a 10-year tranche through 2025. And AGOA is a real manifestation of the bipartisan support for our business engagement with Africa and boosting trade. So the fact that it was renewed for a 10-year period, the idea was to give more confidence to investors so that they wouldn't be uncertain about if I go down this road, will AGOA be renewed the next year, and then the tariff benefits will go away and I won't make as much money as I was projecting. What we would like to see is a broader-based utilization of the AGOA benefits for those countries that are eligible. I think a lot of countries have focused very much in the petroleum sector, and AGOA is a tremendous opportunity to help diversify the economies. I think the shocks we've seen in the petroleum sector in recent years are a validation of many governments' stated desire to diversify the economy, and that is where AGOA can kind of help in those other sectors as well. And so we're looking at how we can, we have some three sub-regional trade hubs that can help provide technical support to different countries and industries to look at how they focus their efforts to take advantage of their eligibility and participation in AGOA.
How do you respond to some critics who say that the Trump administration seems to be focused really on security-related issues? And we are talking, of course, about the fight against terrorism, and that the Trump administration is missing in action when it comes to promoting American values, which translate into democracy, good governance, and rule of law in Africa.
I would say that they're not very observant. First of all, it's very hard to have development take place when there are existential security threats. So by all means, there is an emphasis on security partnerships. And our approach has been to advise, accompany, and assist, and really build partner capacity so that, you know, the United States isn't out there doing it for a sovereign nation, but we're helping provide capabilities and capacity so that they can take charge of their own security, because that's more of a teach a man to fish than give a fish type philosophy. But the other elements are still there, as I mentioned, in this policy that we do have, and it does include an emphasis on the private sector. I think that the aid levels in the past are not exactly sustainable, so we're looking at how to connect U.S. investors with possibilities and opportunities on the continent. And then, as I explained earlier, the linkage between governance and economic opportunity and security is crystal clear. If with the youth bulge that Africa is facing, if young people have no hope and feel that there's no opportunity, then they're going to be more tempted to get in a boat and you know, try to cross the desert and go someplace else to contribute to development someplace else, if they even survive the trip. What we would like to see is that they have opportunities at home, whether in the high-tech sector, innovation, or more traditional pursuits, but again, in a more diversified economy that's more sustainable and that will withstand the various shocks that are tied to kind of a single-focused economy.
You know, there are some who say that with regards to previous administrations, by now there should be a U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Any particular reason why so far that particular position is not yet dealt with?
Well, what I can say is it's my understanding that there is someone in the process, in the pipeline, and we have a very rigorous vetting process. It's a position that requires congressional approval. So even before nominations are announced, there are consultations with Congress. Again, this is a strength of our democracy in terms of the checks and balances. And so many of our positions are subject to Senate confirmation. So I would say that it's not because there isn't someone who's sort of in the process, but these things, you can't predict how long these different processes will take. So I think you could see, not just in the State Department, but throughout the executive branch, there are a number of vacancies, and it is because this is a rather prolonged process. So I wouldn't draw any misplaced conclusions that, oh, there's a deliberate effort not to have an African Assistant Secretary for African Affairs. We have Don Yamamoto, who is our acting, has been acting in that capacity since he rejoined the Bureau in September. We have, you know, a number of senior people who are focused on moving the relationships forward. As the Secretary himself said during the trip, having someone who has the imprimatur of Senate confirmation can be very helpful in terms of connecting the career people to the political appointees. And so we look forward to having that at some point in the near future. But I'm not going to get out in front of any White House announcement on that.
I see. Thank you very much. And you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, including our social media segment. So please, don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
This is a country that I chose to become a citizen. I didn't have to become a citizen. I chose to become a citizen.
I feel like America gave me an opportunity to pursue my passion as an artist.
I really believe that clean eating is a way to a more successful life, or a happier life, if you want to put it that way.
One of the things that helps me wake up every morning is doing better, being better.
We grew up poor, and so I'm always focused on helping the working class be able to have a more comfortable lifestyle.
I'm passionate about doing justice every day. I oftentimes say that justice is a verb, not a noun. You know, I believe in action and moving the ball forward.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. It's time to bring in today's social media reporter, Esther Gizui-Ewart. Take it away, Esther.
Thanks, Shaka. We've received excellent social media feedback this week. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's first official visit to Africa was also his last. This leads us to the question of the week, which asked, what effect will the firing of U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson have on U.S.-Africa policy? And here's what our respondents said. Let's start with a tweet from Wagoni, who tweets, since no serious and clearly defined moves have been made since last year, maybe the new guy will do more. We have another tweet from Vincent Maloba, who tweets, sacking of Rex Tillerson is inconsequential to the American policy on Africa. Trump has no affairs of the continent in his heart. No Secretary of State will change U.S.-Africa relations. And our last tweet comes from Filippo Nen Papa, who tweets, it all comes down to the convictions of replacement. I think it will become more protectionist-leaning, less diplomatic, and highly erratic, given that the replacement shares the same views and probably approach. So we'll see more apprehensive approach from other countries. Now to our social media comment of the week from our Facebook fan, Mohammed Ahmed Mansour from Liberia, who writes, the firing of the American Secretary of State Rex Tillerson at the end of his first African tour last week appears to have deepened the sense of indifference by Africans towards the United States. Now, many Africans are tamping down the expectations of U.S. President Donald Trump even more. And let's go to another comment from a Facebook fan, Joel Tura from Kenya, who writes, "It means nothing to Africa because relations between Africa and the U.S. are already fragile." And our last Facebook comment comes from Anthony Okwenye from Uganda, who writes, "I don't think the U.S. is interested in a one Africa policy. It appears they prefer to deal with each African country bilaterally when the need arises. That's fair enough." A reminder that we appreciate all of our audience feedback. And if you're a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. To comment on our Facebook page, just enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com. To join our YouTube channel, sign up to VOA TV to Africa. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook, or simply go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website. To watch us live on your mobile device, download the VOA mobile app. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a discussion on the challenges of political transitions in Africa. Controversy recently in Kenya after opposition candidate Raila Odinga rejected Uhuru Kenyatta's election victory. Sierra Leone holds a runoff vote for president on March 27th after the two leading candidates failed to secure a 55% majority. Egyptians are headed to the polls next week with only two candidates in the race, and incumbent President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi appears to be the clear-cut favorite. The challenges of political transitions in Africa on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Well, Shaka, that's all for today's social media segment. Shaka, you and the guests have a lot of social media comments to discuss. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Esther. And today, of course, we are talking about the Trump administration's U.S.-African policy. And our distinguished guests are Ambassador Stephanie Sullivan, the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, and joining us. Of course, she joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. And here in the studio is Malik Chaka, former director of the Millennium Challenge Corporation. Malik, you heard the social media reaction. Your reaction to that reaction?
For me, I think that U.S.-Africa relations are important. We're talking about the United States of America. We're not talking about Uzbekistan. And for that reason, I think that even if there are bumps in the road, that African countries will come to a working relationship with the United States, and it will be one that's negotiated. It's not big USA and little Africa. Mm-hmm. We're talking about an Africa that's increasingly important from an economic standpoint. We're talking about an Africa where the fight against terrorism is located. We're talking about an Africa where you have more agricultural potential and more available arable land than anywhere else in the world. So for me, I think that the relationship will change, and I think that it will improve.
Now, Malik, you have interacted with Africa for several decades. You even lived in Tanzania at one time. You used to work on Capitol Hill. We're talking about being a professional member of congressman at one time, Donald Payne?
Mr. Payne and Mr. Royce.
And Mr. Royce. You've also worked, of course, for many years at the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which was founded back in 2004.
Yes.
You've traveled very extensively in Africa. What kind of voices have you been hearing as far as comparing and contrasting this administration with previous administrations?
I think the jury is still out. Folks on the continent are somewhat perplexed. An event like the firing of Mr. Tillerson or the unfortunate remarks that were attributed to President Trump, these so-called comments, have not contributed to us having a positive relationship.
With regards to the uncomplimentary comments, I think the African leaders have said that that is water under the bridge. They have decided to move on. They said that the president wrote a letter to them and they understood.
And I hear that loud and clear, and it's smart to move on. But when you couple the unfortunate remarks with the Secretary of State going to Africa and having important discussions, and he's no longer there, I think we need a situation where there's going to be stability. And I think we also need one where U.S.-Africa policy is codified, where it's written down in some place, where you don't have to guess about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ambassador Sullivan, I gather that you served in Africa, and it was then, of course, Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of the Congo, as a Peace Corps. You also served as U.S. ambassador to what used to be called Congo Brazzaville, now Republic of Congo. What do you hear when you interact with Africans? What kind of voices do you hear?
Well, Shaka, that's a very, very broad question. I think, you know, there's always an interest and a hunger for engagement with the United States. And let me just remind people that we have embassies that represent 49 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And it's not only the president or the secretary of state that is in charge of all of our interactions with African countries and the people of Africa. So we have embassies in, we have 45 embassies who represent the 49 countries, as some of the embassies are duly accredited. And we have our mission at the USAU in Addis. And we find that there is a very strong, steady engagement across administrations. And so perhaps some people are putting a little bit too much emphasis on, you know, what is it? What does the picture look like from Washington, where we have just a very robust engagement in all of the three areas that I spoke about, to include trade and development, regional security, including counterterrorism, which is a big focus now. Unfortunately, we wish it weren't necessary, but it is. And then governance. And governance is a very broad area, and you don't always measure engagement by dollars, because we do have a lot of programs that we participate in that work on youth empowerment. You mentioned earlier the Mandela Washington Fellowships and the Young African Leaders Initiative. We have African Women's Entrepreneur Program that is building up a network of women entrepreneurs and helping them have a better technical sense of how to move their businesses forward. And each of those businesses employs a number of people. We have rule of law programs. We have exchanges with members of parliament. So not everything is measured in the size of an envelope. And we are working very determinedly and in a very committed manner throughout our embassies on the continent, as well as in the Africa Bureau and the other bureaus in the State Department that focus on Africa, as well as our other U.S. government agencies, whether it's AID, the Department of Defense. We have still Peace Corps in many countries in Africa. Commerce, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office. I mean, There's a very committed cadre of people working to advance U.S.-Africa relations. So I've taken note of Malik's suggestion that we find kind of a easier one-stop shopping to write this down in a more accessible manner. And maybe that will put an end to this oft-repeated, oh, there is no Africa policy.
What about your competition with another superpower, which is China? I would like you to talk to me, really, from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your American heart and soul. How do you respond to some critics who say the reason you seem to be soft on good governance, promoting good governance and democracy, is precisely because you happen to compete with the Chinese who do not care about that?
Well, first I would say that we're not soft on these governance and democracy issues. And we bring our American values with us that we model, and that we, if you want to talk about, let's say, human rights, it's very important for the citizenry to have a trusting relationship with the security services. There was a recent UNDP report that cited a figure of 71% of people radicalized in Africa became radicalized following a negative interaction with a member of the security services in their country, either a direct experience or a member of their family. So these are important areas that are interrelated with all the other key elements of our policy. As far as China, I mean, I think, as we all know, Africa is a big continent, and there's a lot of room, a lot of potential, a lot of need for investment. So our message is not, oh, China shouldn't invest here. Our message is more, and this was a message that the secretary communicated during the trip, was that countries should go in open and be careful about getting themselves into some sort of unsustainable debt. There are many countries that often have been several years of debt freedom following the highly indebted poor countries initiative, and then they turn around and get more debt that in some cases is with China. That's not really something that can be, renegotiated. And so it's very important for countries to look at, you know, the value of what they're getting. Is it a company that's going to come in and provide employment for the youth in a community, or are they going to bring in all the workers? Is this a company that is going to build capacity and help leave behind not just infrastructure but also know-how and knowledge so that next time maybe a country can work on the infrastructure project on their own? And so also with the debt, if it's a sovereign asset, whether it's a port or some sort of a road network or electricity grid, is this something that being saddled with a debt that may come due one day could jeopardize the sovereignty and that nation's control of that asset? So these are the conversations that we had very frankly with our partners with whom the Secretary Tillerson met during the recent trip.
Now, talking about the recent trip, of course, you stopped in Addis Ababa. One of your key allies, is Ethiopia. To what extent are you concerned about the state of emergency declared in Ethiopia, for example, and the continuing mass protests, specifically in Oromia region?
Well, as I indicated earlier, human rights remains on the agenda. We have expressed publicly and privately our, let's say, lack of enthusiasm for the current state of emergency. I think that the current state of emergency is perhaps providing some space where the negotiations can take place in order to have a new prime minister emerge. And that is something that once there's a new prime minister, we would welcome their having another look at the state of emergency and see if that's really the right way to go, because we believe that having more freedom rather than less freedom is a way to advance one's national development.
What about the Democratic Republic of Congo?
Well, we note that many emissaries of President Kabila have insisted that he has no intention of running again, and I think that that is good for the long-term stability of the DRC. We're also working with other partners, including with the AU, to impress upon and encourage the need to hold those elections credibly before the end of 2018. You might say that that election timetable is already in injury time compared to the San Silvestre agreement of 2016.
How do you respond to some people who say that, yes, you would like President Joseph Kabila not to run again, and yet you really haven't done anything about that large neighborhood? We're talking about Sassou-Nguesso, for example, in the Republic of Congo. We're talking about Paul Kagame in Rwanda. We're talking about Pierre Nkurunziza in Burundi, who is coming up with a referendum sometime in May so that he could actually become perhaps a presidential monarch. We're talking about Yoweri Museveni of Uganda.
Well, I would say, again, that it's important to be able to have credible processes where citizens are comfortable expressing their opinion, whether it's about a referendum or an actual election. I think in some cases, term limits were part of a solution to a conflict. And then when the term limit is tampered with, if you will, by whatever mechanism, that can reopen some old wounds. And I think that when we look at long-term stability, I think it's really important that citizens feel they have a vote and that they are able to freely express their opinion without fear of being shut down or of things being manipulated. And I would say that would be true throughout the world.
Malika, talk to us about the role of the Millennium Challenge account in as far as Africa is concerned. First of all, how many countries are benefiting out of the Millennium Challenge account in Africa?
In the African context, we're talking about 16 countries have benefited from Millennium Challenge compacts. A larger number of have benefited from... if you put them together, benefited from the threshold programs, which I was responsible for.
Threshold?
Yes.
First of all, tell us, what's the difference between compact and threshold?
Compacts are our most selective program. Countries have to demonstrate that they rule justly, invest in people, and practice economic freedom. You're talking about larger amounts of money. Tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars over a five-year period of time, with the focus on poverty reduction through economic growth. With the threshold program, you're talking about smaller dollar amounts, shorter periods of time, and the focus there is on governance. You are attempting to address issues like corruption. You are attempting to impact policy reform in the telecom sector, for example. We have a number of countries that have benefited from more than one with two compacts. So today I could point to Senegal, I could point to Ghana, I could point to Benin, I could point to Burkina Faso as examples of countries that are having a second compact. But what's critical here is that in order to have a compact, governance is extremely important. We previously, for example, worked in Tanzania, and right. I shouldn't say we because I'm a retired gentleman. Mm-hmm. And the program was ended because of concerns about governance, including the election in Zanzibar, and including the issue of using the internet as a way of cracking down on the population. So for me, what's important about this program is poverty reduction through economic growth, but similarly that countries have to earn this money. And this is not the case with many of the countries that the United States supports. If you went to example for Ethiopia, where there are governance issues.
There is certainly not an MCA in Ethiopia.
No, there isn't. And there isn't in a lot of other places, because one of the things we put right up front is that countries have to, in fact, address the issue of control of corruption.
Corruption.
Yes.
You provide, of course, infrastructure, and you try to alleviate poverty.
Exactly.
Which country is the single largest recipient of the MCA, especially Compact? The last time I saw it was Tanzania.
It was Tanzania with almost $700 million over a five-year period of time. But since that time,
yes,
you've had figures that are approaching $1 billion in those places which have had two compacts.
I see.
Yes.
Well, Madam Ambassador, you have the last word. What would you like to say about U.S. foreign policy to Africa? How should Africans feel about your interaction with them?
I will get to that, but I would just like to tack on to what Malik said about the MCC. I was privileged to represent Deputy Secretary Sullivan at the signing ceremony for Cote d'Ivoire's compact, which was over $500 million. And the Ivoirian president took a very deliberate approach to the criteria and worked with his ministers to improve the indicators in order to qualify. And it's not just about answering the mail or checking the box, but making these changes that will help accelerate economic development in a country. And we have scorecards through the MCC for each of the countries. And I would recommend listeners go to the Millennium Challenge Corporation website and look at the indicators and be active participants in the governance of your country. You don't have to be an elected official to be a leader in your country, and you can work through your elected officials to help them be aware of some of these criteria that really are well thought out and are kind of a recipe for success in terms of economic growth, which is really what everybody wants, the citizens. And the governments should want this, and they should want to help make a better life for the population. Go ahead.
Unfortunately, time happened not to be our best ally.
So very, very briefly, I would say America has not lost enthusiasm for Africa and African countries and Africans. We continue to engage. We have people on the ground. We have people in Washington. And we look forward to welcoming our secretary designate, assuming he's confirmed by the Senate, and helping him see the full array of partnerships.
Well, unfortunately, time is not our best ally. On that note, get better, not bitter, Africa. And let's keep the African hopes alive.